Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you're listening. For most of our 200 and some years, Americans have enjoyed a relatively tranquil attitude about security. We've had more than our share of crime and violence, but nothing to prepare us for an event like an international terrorist conspiracy crashing planes into the towers of the World Trade Center. Since 9/11, we have taken measures to improve our ability to prevent and respond to possible future attacks. And in fact, many of us are concerned we have already gone too far, that fear has driven us to violate the principles of freedom and due process we claim to defend. The Patriot Act has become a focal point for critics of the new focus on homeland security. But how would Americans react if, heaven forbid, we are hit by another catastrophic terrorist attack? During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about some of the measures being taken to address what we now call homeland security and consider how they may radically alter our daily lives in the future. Our guest is Matthew Brzezinski, contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine and former foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We'll talk during this hour with Matthew Brzezinski about his new book, Fortress America, On the Front Lines of Homeland Security, an inside look at the coming surveillance state. It is published by Bantam Books. In his reporting on the subject, Matthew Brzezinski was able to get an inside look at the counterterror initiative and at many of the new technologies, laws, and tactics being deployed or considered, along with our persistent vulnerabilities in the post-9/11 era. And Matthew Brzezinski joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Yes, hi.
Hello. Thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
The United States has always been a very open society compared to nations that have experienced war on their own soil, and suddenly we realize how vulnerable we are. You begin your first chapter by examining just how difficult it would be to actually protect everything that could be a target for terrorists.
Sure, it would be absolutely impossible to protect everything in this country. You know, as you mentioned, we are one of the most open societies in the world. We also happen to be one of the largest countries in the world, and we also happen to be a very populous country in the world and a very wealthy country in the world, which means we have, you know, just so much more infrastructure than many countries, so many more airports than most countries, so many more ports than other countries. You know, if you just look at just our coastline, it's 95,000 miles long. Look at our border with Canada. It's something like 4,000 or 5,000 miles long. So, you know, the largest undefended border in the world. And you know, this was a tremendous dilemma for the people in Washington who after 9/11 were tasked with trying to come up with some sort of a strategy to deal with the threat of terror. And you know, this is why it's very, very important to create priorities, basically, to have what are called vulnerability assessments and to look and say, okay, well, where are we most at risk? We can't do everything, so we have to sort of create a list here and see where we should focus our energies. You know, unfortunately, 3 years after 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security still hasn't done this, and many of the states individually still haven't done this. You know, we right away obviously saw after 9/11 that we are extremely, you know, that our airline industry is extremely vulnerable. So we have, you know, spent billions. We have now spent well over $10 billion making sure nobody walks on a plane with, you know, with box cutters again. You know, however, you know, while we're searching the little old ladies and confiscating their nail files, we still all could be sitting on a bomb because we haven't, you know, we haven't done anything to really screen cargo properly that goes into the belly of those planes that we fly. So, you know, this is an example of, well, we took one priority, but we took the visible priority, the one that, you know, everybody sees when you're, everybody feel, you know, when you're being screened. They wouldn't see the baggage and cargo being checked for bombs because that happens in the bowels of the airport. So that they sort of left. And this is a bit of a problem with, you know, with and symptomatic and a bit of a problem and symbolic of our entire homeland security effort. It's much more about the perception of safety than it is actually about the reality of safety. We remain extraordinarily vulnerable. A good argument, in fact, could be made that we are even, in fact, today not any safer than we were before 9/11, even less safe than we were before 9/11. But because of DHS, and they've really, really, really gone over backwards to give people, the American public, the impression that the government is doing all sorts of things and everything possible to make us safer, when in fact that is not the case.
Mm-hmm. Now, as an example of this, you take a tour of the Baltimore Harbor, and you know there are people sort of pointing out, you know, here's a chemical plant over there. You know, this is a huge storage tank that has, you know, volatile explosive mm-hmm. chemicals. I mean, and the range of potential targets is just kind of mind boggling.
Absolutely, and you know, but a lot of this. And you know, here again is where reality sort of, you know, meets the pavement type of thing. Where, you know, Baltimore and the Baltimore Harbor is just one example of every single city in
right.
this country
mm-hmm.
has these heavy industrial, you know, installations. You know, the chemical industry, there's something like 15,000 plants, according to the EPA, in this country that produce toxic chemicals. And you know, it would be very, very simple to protect them all, and the government wouldn't even have to spend a penny. And this, of course, this is something that right after 9/11, in fact, Congress sought to do when they tabled the Chemical Security Act, which would codify perimeter security at all these plants and regulate the transport of chemicals. You know, give me one example. You know, while they're moving, say, chlorine or ammonia or something like that, a single rail car filled with it has 33,000 gallons of the stuff, and it can kill 100,000 people. The sort of toxic cloud that if you blow it up, and so you know, the fear, of course, was that you would have some sort of a chemical Chernobyl, and that, you know, this had bipartisan support. But unfortunately, the energy companies and the American Petroleum Institute, which is the main lobby arm of all the oil companies, just didn't want to spend the money on perimeter fences and cameras and better lighting and security guards and so on and so forth. And it was a lot cheaper for them to donate $5.7 million to the campaigns of the Republican senators that had initially also backed the bill.
Mm-hmm.
They withdrew. The White House sort of lost interest in the bill, and we're successful in quashing this legislation. And, you know, so this is an example of, well, here we've identified a priority. And the military, in fact, ranks, the Pentagon's done studies, and they rank, you know, the possibility of a chemical plant being targeted by a terrorist as a second only in terms of devastation to a nuclear event in this country. So we know this is an example of something. We know this is a huge area of vulnerability. We know this is a problem. But corporate interests have trumped national security, and 3 years after 9/11, you know, our plants are just as vulnerable as they were before. And I think that's, you know, that's very, very sad.
Oh, I certainly want to talk more about the Department of Homeland Security, but there are a lot of other issues in your book that are worthy of discussion, and I hope we can get to at least some of them. But one of the, you know, what we're speaking about, the things that haven't been done, and you know, whether we are safer or not after 9/11, which is, you know, a big issue in the presidential campaign
mm-hmm.
right now. One issue you raise with the DHS is that it hasn't been given the resources to do the job, partly at least, or maybe largely, because of the war in Iraq.
Oh, I mean, unfortunately, there's no question that Iraq is bleeding away, hemorrhaging away resources from the home front here. You know, I was amazed everywhere I went in this country, and you know, on both coasts and in the Midwest, and every place that I visited and talked to people who work on the front lines of Homeland Security, at the dire money shortages, starting at the very top in Washington D.C. at the headquarters of DHS, right down to the people who man our ports and borders and things like that. There's no money anywhere. I'll give you one example of you know, just how much money is being, and the comparison between what money is being spent in Iraq and what's being spent at home here. Let's take the example of, you know, we all fear that our worst nightmare is, you know, the specter of a nuclear detonation
mm-hmm.
in a major American city. And the way that terrorists would get a nuclear device into this country is through a cargo container, a shipping container. And, you know, you have something like in the order of 17 or something million of these that come in by air, sea, and land. By the sea component, about 7 million or so come in through ships. Far and away, the largest port in the United States is L.A. Long Beach, and it handles about 40% of seaborne cargo containers. And when Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge decided to have a media day there earlier this summer to sort of, you know, tout the security upgrades for the press, well, they realized, holy smokes, we don't have a radiation portal. Our radiation portal is a device, actually, it kind of looks like, remember the Black Obelix in 2001,
oh, sure.
Space,
oh, yeah.
Odyssey?
Mm-hmm.
It looks something like that. And what it does is it's essentially a very sophisticated Geiger counter that measures background radiation, and that, you know, that has all kinds of alarms that'll go off if it picks up a reading that is too high. And, you know, the point is that we can't open these millions of cargo containers. So we've got to find, you know, we've got to sort of tap our technology to find ways to screen them quickly and efficiently. And they're devising these radiation portals. But the Port of Los Angeles, which handles 40% of all traffic, didn't have one of these things. So they flew one in a couple of days before Tom Ridge was supposed to get there and set it up and to tout, you know, to show the media, hey, look, you know, look how well protected we are. We've got a radiation portal. To me, I mean, that's sinful. I mean, that's almost like a sin. I mean, that's Potemkin security. And one of these things is not very expensive. It's $88,000. And to outfit, you know, every single port, every single airport, every single sort of, you know, key bridge, you have put these things on bridges coming into New York City or tunnels coming into New York City or any major city would cost roughly $300 million, according to estimates. Now, that's about what we spend each and every day in Iraq, and we only have the money for about 10% of that. I'll give you another example. When I was in L.A., I went out with the U.S. Coast Guard with their sea marshals, and they board sort of suspect ships. It's actually extremely dangerous and acrobatic feats where they leap from one moving ship to another, and they could get crushed between the hulls. And it's very frightening and dangerous work. They were cutting back on these kind of boardings because the cost of diesel had gone up so much, and there wasn't money in the budget. Now, meanwhile, you know, we're paying Halliburton up to $2.65 a gallon to distribute gas in Baghdad for cab drivers, and you know, it's just, to me, you know, there's something wrong with this, you know, and Halliburton's gotten $17 billion of contracts in Iraq, all told. Now that's more than three times the FBI's entire annual budget, and when the FBI earlier this year asked for a $12 million extra appropriation so we could hire 80 more agents and analysts, counterterror analysts, and some linguists, they were told, no, there's no money for you. There's no, I mean, so, you know, we're denying ourselves gas here for our Coast Guard. We won't give our FBI, our prime domestic agency in the war on terror, 12 measly million dollars. And you know, we're throwing money like crazy away at I mean, you probably all hear the stories of if they're literally throwing away brand new $100,000 tractor trailers. If this thing, you know, in Iraq, if it gets a flat tire in the wrong neighborhood or on the wrong stretch of highway that's controlled by the insurgents, it's too dangerous to stop, change the tire, or sometimes they don't have this, you know, a small mechanical failure, they don't have the spare parts, they just abandon it. So, you know, we're literally throwing money away, burying it in the sand over there, and you know, here we're nickel and diming ourselves, and you know, and it's almost as if we have all our eggs in one basket over there. But what if Iraq doesn't stop all global terrorism? You know, and somebody does manage to get the United States, we've left ourselves, you know, my theory is we've left ourselves extremely vulnerable here, and maybe we should, you know, refocus our priorities a bit.
We're talking this morning with Matthew Brzezinski. He's contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of the book we're discussing, Fortress America, On the Front Lines of Homeland Security, an inside look at the coming surveillance state. And we do have a caller waiting, and we'll talk with them and welcome others. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a caller waiting patiently on line number 4 from Belgium, which is near Danville, Illinois, not in Europe. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't want to belittle the shortcomings of the present administration, but I would like to point out the real interesting aspect of this whole terrorism thing, and how amazingly intelligent their actions were. They used minimal amount of money to inflict an amazing amount of cost to us by striking these buildings. But the most insidious thing about it is I'm in a little community here, maybe 500 people, and everybody worries to death that we're going to be struck by a terrorist. There's no terrorist going to come to Belgium, Illinois. Not on the worst dreams would they want to come here. But yet everybody here worries about it just as much as if we were, you know, standing in downtown Baghdad. And I can't imagine how much worse it could be with such a simple amount of money that was put towards it. You know, we go to war to fight this group of people who aren't even involved with this group of the terrorists, and we go on and on about this. And how much more unintelligent can our actions be?
Well, the caller has an excellent point. You know, it's interesting that there was a survey recently, and I think that something like 42% of Americans said that, they fear, they fear themselves becoming victims of terrorism. Well, you know, hey, newsflash, you know, statistically, you or I or any of your listeners have about, you know, as good a chance of becoming a victim of terrorism as, you know, as winning a lottery, you know, twice over and getting struck by lightning in the very same day. But, you know, what's odd is that I think, you know, we partly, you know, certainly the government, but we partly in the media, mostly the government, but we partly in the media are also responsible for this, because sort of, you know, every time you turn on your local news or your national news or you open your newspaper, it's sort of, you know, become a national obsession. If it bleeds, it leads. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of covering the latest, you know, threat from Washington or FBI warning or this or that. Oh, they're gonna poison your water supply. They're gonna blow up your shopping center. They're gonna use crop dusters. They're gonna use limousines to attack us all. There really has been a lot of sort of fear mongering. And as I place the principal blame on the government, on DHS, on this administration, and the reason for that is perhaps twofold. One, you know, we had, as you mentioned at the opening of the show, we've had so little experience with terrorism in this country that, you know, that we had very much a knee-jerk overreaction. It was a little bit like, you know, like when the movie Jaws first came out. You know, everybody went, you know, had shark fever. We had a bit of that here as well. And I guess the cynics would say that the government has its own agenda in issuing so many and such vague, you know, terrorist warnings all the time. But the media has really, you know, in the cable, especially the 24-hour cable news networks have really run with this. And there's a fascinating study that was done that showed that the people who and I forget the exact statistic, but a surprisingly significant percentage of the American people had manifested some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder after 9/11. Those who suffered the most tended to live the furthest away from New York or Washington, but watched the most television. It just seemed as if, you know, I think, you know, we in the media do share a bit of responsibility for this. You know, I mean, here we are right now just talking about this subject. So, there's blame all around for that. But your caller has a very good point.
Yeah. Well, I think the media has done what it does very well in recent years. It's packaged the war on terror with theme music and logos and just, you know, slickly produced features. And that's really what the media does the best. It's become a product of the media.
And the government has done what it does best, which is two things: nothing, and overreact wildly.
We have several callers waiting. There's so much I want to get to, and I hope we can. But I will defer to a caller who's been waiting very patiently. Line number one, someone in Urbana. Good morning.
Hello. Would you comment on this new missile defense shield in regards to, it seems like if a terrorist wanted to disrupt things, he would send it by boat or cross one of our porous borders, and that way there would be no radar footprint from whence it came. And secondly, the fact of the illegal drug transportation, all this is corrupted the borders, and somebody could say, hey, Jose, I want to send in 10 kilos of pot, and you'll get $10,000. And in that, well, he could have a nuclear bomb or a dirty bomb, those two things, the missile defense shield that they're putting up and the illegal transportation of drugs facilitating a shipment of a dirty bomb.
Okay.
Well, this missile defense shield is actually causing a bit of a stir here in Washington. I think recently 49 former generals and admirals and sort of very senior military officials who've recently retired sent an open letter to Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, basically saying, hey, look, you know, the money can be a lot better spent. That, you know, that in today's world, a missile shield is essentially a Cold War relic. And in today's world, you know, the primary threat is, as the caller said, is a non-state actor that isn't going to have a intercontinental ballistic missile at their disposal, but they might have a briefcase bomb or some vials of smallpox. And the missile shield does absolutely nothing to defend us against that, but it is extraordinarily expensive. It's a $50 billion proposition, and that's much more than we spend on all our homeland security.
And that's if it actually works.
If it actually works, exactly. And all evidence seems to point that it probably won't work in the near future. And you know, this year alone, we're gonna spend $10 billion. On this missile defense shield, and that's more than twice the entire budget of the FBI. It's more than twice the entire budget of U.S. Customs, and you know, who are in charge of protecting our borders and making sure somebody doesn't smuggle something in. Now, you know, as for the caller's second question, I'm not sure how much corruption there is along the border. I've actually spent quite a bit of time. And not just preparing for this book, but on previous stories where I've done a lot on drug smuggling, and I've found that overwhelmingly the people who do man our borders, are very dedicated and very honest, and there may be the occasional case where there is some corruption, but the corruption is not the issue. You know, you don't even need to pay people off, given that 4,000 people a day walk across the Mexican border, into the United States. So why pay somebody off when the border's so open anyways? It's an issue, we're beginning to redeploy new sorts of technology. They're right now testing new drones, the same sort of drones that we used in Iraq and Afghanistan, along the Mexican-U.S. border, and this is one of our many vulnerabilities. And at some point, the caller has a point that the terrorist groups will realize that, hey, it's just so difficult to get into this country legally right now. Why don't we just walk across the border, in Arizona or New Mexico or wherever. And that'll simplify our situation. So yeah, the caller has a valid point as well.
We're a little past our midpoint here with Matthew Brzezinski, author of the book Fortress America: On the Front Lines of Homeland Security, an inside look at the coming surveillance state. We have a couple callers waiting, and we'll get right to them. Other calls are welcome around Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Next up, a Chicago listener on line number 2. Good morning.
Hi. I've been really disturbed by those kind of bizarre announcements and warnings that seem to continually come from Homeland Security. And the last thing that really struck me was when they said that this, they got it off a computer, so they felt that this was really serious. And I thought to myself, why, just because you've got a printed copy, is this so more secure information than any other. And then I heard that there's only one analyst in the Department of Homeland Security, and that the FBI has a backlog of untranslated information that they've gathered, untranslated from Arabic, that two-thirds of it has not been translated into English, which means it hasn't been examined. And I guess all I'm saying is the reason why we get these unsubstantiated warnings and the reason why the Justice Department has so far, I think, has no conviction against anyone for terrorism, because we don't have any analysts who are actually looking at data, and we don't seem to have translators. So we really don't have any facts. We just have rumors.
There's a tremendous amount of truth to that. Yes, I mean the backlog for untranslated surveillance logs right now, I think, is 123,000 hours. And in terms of these extremely vague warnings, most of them are not, I don't believe, based on very substantial sort of intelligence. A lot of them are like, well, in Madrid they Al Qaeda disrupted an election, so obviously they might want to try it here. So we've got to talk about that warning, or it's July 4th. Well, wouldn't they like to hit us on July 4th? Well, then we've got to issue a warning. So it's almost like people are looking at the calendar and guessing. And there is a tremendous amount of that going on, and part of that is because we do lack so little, intelligence, and B, there is a shortage of capable analysts. At DHS, there was an extreme shortage of capable analysts, especially at the beginning, partly because they didn't have their computers weren't secure, so they couldn't receive classified information at DHS. And again, this was the fault of the White House because they didn't want to give them that clearance. There's no question that we have a shortage of analysts, we have a shortage of translators, and we have a shortage of human intelligence. Most of what we're getting, it seems we're getting from places like Pakistan, from the arrest of people who are then rendered to other places and essentially tortured. And most of the warnings that we're hearing are just they're stabbing in the dark. And why, you ask yourself, well, why would they do this, and expose themselves to such ridicule? They're not entirely stupid, the people, who run this whole thing. The cynics would say they have a plan, and that there is, there is a method to the madness, and issuing all these sorts of warnings, they're doing that for a reason. And the extreme cynics here in Washington would say their reason is that they want to scare us, and that they want to scare us because if we're not scared, and particularly as more time goes by since 9/11 and there's not a repeat event, we will start asking ourselves, well, do we really need all these very intrusive laws that were passed in the Patriot Act? Do we really need to give all these new powers to law enforcement agencies? And we will start repealing a lot of these things. And as you saw, as you may have heard, a judge, for instance, in New York just yesterday ruled that, well, no, the FBI shouldn't have the right to look at your internet records, and which it does, without the company informed, your internet provider informing you that somebody's been, looking into what websites you've been visiting and so on and so forth. But the only reason that those laws will be kept on the books is if the public, the general public, agrees for those things. It doesn't kick up a big stir, and the way to keep us docile is to scare us, into believing that those laws are necessary. So the extreme cynics would say that that the purpose of issuing all these crazy warnings is really to keep all these draconian and very invasive Patriot Act type laws on the books.
Just a quick follow up, and then I'll get on to some more callers who are waiting patiently. Immediately after 9/11, the federal government rounded up hundreds or thousands of people who were similar to the hijackers who fit the profile, so to speak. It's one of those situations where many, or perhaps most of us, can understand it's an extraordinary measure in extraordinary times, but it also violates some of our deepest national values. And you know, from reading about the results, one wonders if there, it was effective at all. And, you know, you tell some stories of some people got caught up in that.
Very tragic stories.
Yeah.
And really paid the price. And this is something that, you know, that I can understand, as you point out, I think we could all understand that, you know, that in the days and weeks that followed 9/11, that not only with 9/11, but if you were all recall that, you know, the anthrax scares, and where, you know, I lived in Georgetown, people were setting up makeshift mailboxes. They were wearing rubber gloves to get their mail. I mean, they're really, we were all really frightened. So I can understand in this period of paranoia, and very justified paranoia, that we would overreact, that our law enforcement agencies would, you know, start snatching people up, basically using, you know, some very loose criteria that, you know, well, okay, if you're a young male Muslim immigrant, you know, that's already a major strike against you. And if you just happen to have any sort of, you know, kind of circumstantial evidence that might, you know, make you suspicious, well, then, you know, we'd better have a talk with you. And then, you know, then rounding all these people up. My problem with that is that, you know, it should have very quickly become apparent to the FBI that, you know, the people that were rounded up really had nothing to do with terrorism. And those people should have been, you know, issued an apology and let go. But instead, you know, they were left to languish for months and months and months in prisons with, you know, and then their families didn't know where they just disappeared off the streets. Families didn't know what they were. They were for months on end, they were denied access to counsel. And essentially, you know, I mean, this was, you know, the sort of Gestapo tactics, basically, you know, where fundamentally un-American, where you're guilty until, you know, you're presumed guilty until proven innocent. And it's up to you to prove yourself innocent, which is very hard to do when you're locked up in an isolation cell without access even to a lawyer or you can't even talk to your wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was a very, very dangerous, I think, precedent because very soon from out of that, you know, grew the whole idea of enemy combatants, you know, that the president could, you know, could declare anyone an enemy combatant. And again, you know, the courts have sort of said, well, you know, recently the Supreme Court sort of said, well, no, Mr. President, you can't do that. And you know, that so that, you know, in many ways, the pendulum, if it swung way, 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 you know, to the side of overreaction, is now sort of coming back to the, you know, to reaching its equilibrium again. And, you know, and we're starting to question the value of many of the things that we did. And hopefully, you know, if God forbid there ever is another terrorist event, there will be an extraordinary amount of pressure to repeat that sort of overreaction, to take those sort of measures again. And hopefully, you know, saner minds will prevail and say, well, you know, last time we did this and you know, we got nothing out of it. So maybe that's not the right way to go this time.
We have several callers waiting, and we'll go next to a listener in Champaign County on line number one. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have two major points, and the first one you've just edged towards, the implication of this roundup with its which the host did mention, so little actual terrorist suspects. One of the things that's done, it's...
No terrorist suspects.
Right. I wasn't sure if that actually happened. I mean, they can say the Lackawanna Five were or something, but they were...
But they were not part of those. Yeah, they were not part of those original 1,200 detainees.
Right. But that's specious, too. They were... my understanding, they were sort of coercively plea bargained, and that...
They were threatened with being declared enemy combatants.
Right. So it's gone beyond that even. The point is that the Muslim community in this country, which could have been cooperative after 9/11 and was actually, was totally traumatized and worse. Those people could have translated Arabic. They could have been double checked by somebody else. But you know, the point is that it's not only not productive, it was counterproductive. It's really poisoned a lot of the circumstance, and the polarization is amazing. But my question is more about human intelligence than these technical fixes that ever talked about, the border control, and so that's why I raised that point.
Well, but, you know, the point you also raised, that, you know, when you're talking about co-opting you know, the Muslim immigrant community, it's not only the people that were sort of rounded up and thrown in jail without due process. If you recall, then we sort of said, well, we have to register all sort of Muslims. We're going to have to come in for registry. And so people started coming in, and they'd come in, and we'd lock them up, and we deported 13,000.
Right.
And yes, the net result of this is that who in their right mind in the Muslim community in America right now, which, as you pointed out rightfully, they're going to be the first to get wind of some suspicious character or newcomer or something like that. They'll know this way ahead of us or the FBI. But, you know, the last thing they want to do is go talk to the authorities, because everyone, you know, remembers that, well, the last, you know, our neighbors who did this or whatever, are, you know, got put on a plane and sent back to, you know, wherever. Absolutely, there could have been a wealth of information and potential informants and whatnot that we've just turned our back on and completely turned away. And that's a wasted resource.
I wanted to now turn to the terror warning and the manipulation. I guess what you would call an extreme cynic outside of the Beltway. And I wondered if you noted Ridge's apology about the roll-up of this. I think the previous caller actually referred to the incident of the computer expert who was actually a mole being run by British and Pakistani intelligence. And Ridge just in the last couple of days apologized for revealing this guy's name while the British were still using him. I don't think it's an accident that it happened during Tony Blair's little show over there. He needs to show that he has some cooperation from the U.S., but it's not being noted much here. And if one recalls the timing of that particular terror warning, et cetera, when they rolled this up, it coincided with the beginning of the just before the Democratic convention.
Mm-hmm.
And my allegation is, and I think there's fairly good substantiation, that that's why they did it. They were manipulating the media. They're manipulating the terror. They didn't give a hang if the British were getting more intelligence from this guy. He was corresponding by email with his previous contacts with Al Qaeda. They had flipped this guy, and they were using him. And the U.S. Ridge and crew burnt the guy, burnt the whole operation, because they needed to raise the terror warning, because they needed to manipulate the terror. It is absolutely outrageous, and if Kerry had any cojones, he'd get up and say that tonight.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And it was, I mean, it's they needed to justify. It's not that they needed to raise the warning. They needed to justify raising it, because we've all become so cynical. So they raised it. And we were all sort of going, there was a lot of sort of, yeah, right, okay, here, there you go again type of thing, reaction from the general population. And so, you know, to see, well, no, look, we really do have, here's the, you know, concrete evidence, here's the evidence. And they rolled this, you know, and this is, you know, Han, you're disclosing Han's identity. And, you know, this, again, this is an example of, you know, politics, Trump, you know, Trump national security. It's obviously insanity. You know, that the Department of Homeland Security, for security reasons, often tell us, we can't tell you this, we can't tell you that, just trust us for security. And here they are disclosing something that, for obvious security reasons, should not be disclosed, when they feel that we're starting to doubt their word. So as evidence, they do this. And you know, that whole little, you know, very ugly situation, I think tells us everything that's wrong with DHS right now. That, you know, that clearly, it's seen as a political, by more and more people, it's not trusted and seen as a political tool. And its actions, and even when it tries to defend itself, such as that case, you know, seem to confirm that, in fact, it is primarily motivated, you know, by partisan politics. And this is it's very unfortunate, and I think it's very dangerous for the security of this nation.
If I might have one more point, I haven't actually been having internet access the last 2 days because I just had minor surgery and I'm away from my computer, but I'm doing well, thank you. What kind of reaction to this apology by Ridge came out in the press? Is anybody taking this as a lead? Is anybody doing it? Or are they cowed by the administration? I mean, now CBS won't even roll out the story about the fabricated documents from Niger. I mean, it's. I guess I'm digressing a bit. I'll let someone else have a chance.
Okay, thanks for the call.
All right.
The people aren't jumping all over that story. Yeah. But you know, to sort of defend the media, it's it's there's a lot of things going on right now, and that's really not, you know, it's really people who don't want to make a mountain out of a mole. And you know, it would be just repeating what a lot of the columnists have written and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So it's not such a big story. No.
Well, the media is so focused on the debate tonight right
exactly
now.
Right.
I do have a call, and I promise I'll get to them, but I really want to make sure that we talk a little bit about the surveillance technology that you cover in the book. It's, you know, I forget who said, you know, no matter how paranoid you are, you just can't keep up. The technology that's coming online, whether it's satellite imaging or television cameras or video cameras by the thousands in public places, it's something that very few people are aware of, really. But it's a pretty dramatic development in terms.
Well, don't you have something like that on the way in your neck of the woods, over in Chicago, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah, they're installing 6,000 more cameras in Chicago, I believe.
With software that can detect "quote unquote" abnormal behavior.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's look, we're this is just the beginning, and everything from everything from your cell phone to your car, everything is gonna is gonna be GPS enabled, and some by law. I mean, our cell phones, the FCC is as of I think it's 2006. There's it's 911. It's kind of a new line 911 regulation.
Mm-hmm.
But just as when a line, when you call 911 from a landline, the operator automatically knows exactly where you're calling from.
Sure.
Well, they want the same thing for cell phones.
Right.
But that means that they can track you at any time they want, as well, not just when you're calling 911. And so the cell phones are automatically going to come with GPS enabled chips in them. Same thing with your cars right now. More and more models have OnStar features.
Mm-hmm.
And with OnStar, they can remotely turn on your car, turn it off, unlock your doors, and of course track you. I think this is even in the Lacey Peterson trial, which I haven't been following very closely, but I did happen to notice that the defense was arguing very much against the piece of evidence that was introduced using the OnStar feature.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember his name, but whoever is suspected of killing his wife there, of his vehicle, and these are very little mundane tools that we use in our everyday lives, and of course computers. The proposal, I don't remember if you called the Total Information Awareness Program,
right,
that Rear Admiral Poindexter over at the Pentagon here was cooking up. The Congress fortunately put some severe brakes on that, but that would have created essentially the biggest sort of supercomputer in the world that could track billions and billions and billions of gigabytes of information on your every click of your mouse, on your every sort of every time you bought anything online, and that the government would have a record of every single thing you did electronically, every bill you paid. And from those things, vast computer, very sophisticated computer programs would start building profiles. And, it is astonishing that, what's happening right now in the area of surveillance, it isn't just, sort of the cameras, although, as I speak to you right now here in Washington, the Defense Department, along with DHS, are testing a new blimp that's flying overhead. Everybody's kind of looking up and going, what's this new blimp? Is it because of, the Montreal Expos coming to Washington? No. It's a surveillance blimp with electrical, optical, and infrared, and all these new cameras that they're testing. And so, it's flying over all our heads. And with infrared and electrical, optical, these things can actually look not only into our backyards, but actually look right through the roof of our homes. The technology that's there is fairly incredible. And it's always two or three steps ahead of the law, which is why, say spammers could annoy us for so long.
Right.
It's really a question of, where the limits to this, there are no limits to how far they can go, and our expectation of privacy sort of recedes, with every year. And, you know, already, I mean, what commercial databases know about us all is incredible. You go, you know, go buy a couch, and the next thing you know, for the next, you know, I don't know how many months, you're going to be getting catalogs in the mail from the Crate and Barrels or, you know what I mean, or IKEAs or whatnot. Get a credit card, and you're going to be bombarded with solicitations from every credit card company in America. Now, how do they know that, you know, you just got a credit card? The information is all, you know, sold already in the private sector. But what's happening right now, and this is a first in history, is, you know, up to now there's been a bit of a Chinese wall between what the private sector knows about you and what the government knows about you. Well, that's coming down, where the government is now starting to have access to all these commercial databases. And there's a big program. I believe Illinois was one of the states that may or may not have been participated in this. It's called Matrix, out of Florida, which is essentially the Total Information Awareness Program, where it's a data mining operation, and it's government, it's government, you know, mining the private sector for information.
Yeah.
And you know that the sky's the limit on what you can find out about somebody once you go there.
Well, I realize that Matrix is an acronym of something, but one can't help sort of, you know, like ironically noting the name of the movie, The Matrix.
Yes.
and the connection there. There's one other technology, and I'm sorry to the callers, but it's really important to at least mention radio frequency ID technology. This is a new thing that. You know, if the idea had been possible during George Orwell's time, I think it would have featured prominently in some of his works.
Oh, absolutely. You know, RFID is, I mean, it's already being used by the private sector again. You know, things like smart tags on all sorts of consumer goods. Things like, for cargo facilities, where people have huge warehouses and to follow inventory and things like that, but you know, take it to the other extreme, and I really wondered whether I should put this in the book and whether I should go there, but I went to a farm in Wyoming, on the border of Colorado and Wyoming, and I watched the cows and cattle and sheep get injected with. These chips that are about about the size of a wild grain of rice, and inside it they're transponder chips, and inside there's a microchip and a little antenna, and this is sort of the cutting edge of this RFID technology. They use this in the cattle industry, so you can track livestock and the thing can. Remotely, you can then see what the temperature of each of a cow is or whatnot, and where it's been and so on and so forth. And you know, in the cattle industry, it's actually a very good way of keeping track, especially if there's an E. coli outbreak and you want to track the source of the meat and whatnot. But you know, naturally, what are the applications for people? And you know, so the veterinarian who was doing this said, well, you know, what Alzheimer's patients. You know, again, you can just inject something like that to people, and an Alzheimer patient wanders off, no ID, no whatever. You know, it has programmed, you program their medical history and their home address and so on and so forth, and it's GPS-enabled. And, you know, I started digging around this, and I kept hearing rumors that China had contracted a Western European company to devise these sort of chips to put into political prisoners. And that our special forces were also, you know, were in situations where they couldn't wear dog tags on black op missions, that they had these things. But I wasn't sure whether, you know, that would be pushing the envelope a little bit and people would, you know, would say I'm exaggerating. But I include all this. But I put it in the book. Well, you know, lo and behold, about 6 weeks ago or so, I read in the paper that the Mexican government has started injecting its top law enforcement officials, the people who fight against the drug cartels, with these sort of chips, and they're GPS enabled, so that if somebody kidnaps them, their bodies can be found. But they also have these little cool features that when including the Prosecutor General of Mexico and whatever, when he goes to a sort of secure office, which is obviously very restricted, he doesn't have to punch in a key code or swipe a card or anything. The door automatically scans him and reads that in his body he's got this microchip and opens the doors for him. So, you know, now we have, you know, our neighboring government is actually using these things. And you know, it's only a matter of time before we start using them here, maybe, you know, put them, as somebody once suggested, put them in sex offenders. Or people said, well, what about all these, you know, people that come to visit the United States, immigrants from Muslim nations? Well, they come here, and maybe they come here on a legal visa, but then they disappear, and we'll never find them again. What about implanting, you know, I mean, one could see all the possible applications of this, and it's positively frightening.
Yeah. Well, there's much more in the book, and I'm sorry to say that we're just about out of time, and there's a couple callers I must apologize to. I left waiting simply too long. You know, as you look at these issues, a final thought here is, you know, the technology, the policy, you know, the balance of resource allocation and so forth. I mean, we're a democracy. Is there something that, you know, people ought to do to better handle the way that we are approaching these issues?
Yeah, I think that they should not take anything that their governments tell them for granted. The worst that, you know, to me, the most frightening sort of phenomenon that I've seen in the last few years is, we can't tell you why, but trust us. We heard this, you know, with the reasons for invading a country, for example.
Yeah.
And it's now costing, you know, it's costing us hundreds of billions of dollars and will continue to cost that. It's costing, you know, already we could say over 1,000 American lives, and will probably cost, you know, many more thousands by the time all is said and done. And at home, you know, it's also costing us our many of the liberties and the freedoms that we cherish so. So, you know, never take anything that your government tells you for granted. Question. All the time. And the more, you know, the more the people question, the more their congressmen will question, their senators will question, their local elected leaders will question, and will put barriers on, you know, and put the brakes on things. Otherwise, you know, I think the government's going to try to get away with whatever it can.
We'll have to stop there. The book is Fortress America on the Front Lines of Homeland Security, an inside look at the coming surveillance state, published by Bantam Books. The author is our guest, Matthew Brzezinski, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.